Are you ready for the quantum age?
Humanity's next step in evolution?
Dream Vision 7 Radio Network invites you to the extraordinary platform of evolutionary voices for the quantum age.
Let's explore. Learn more about this upcoming age where we bridge science with spirituality.
Where potentiality meets reality.
Where we take compassion into action.
Our trailblazers and visionaries will ask the whys, the what ifs, while igniting continuous possibility.
Come along with us into an age beyond what we know today, where we can grow together in unity consciousness.
Experience evolutionary voices for the quantum age Monday through Friday at 8 a.m. and 8 p.m. Eastern on DreamVision7Radio.com. Welcome to Living the Quantum Dream with your host, Cynthia Sue Larson, inviting you to explore ideas about how you can enjoy a better way of life from one of today's top experts in quantum consciousness. Cynthia Sue Larson is a life coach and the best-selling author of Quantum Jumps, Reality Shifts, High Energy Money, and Aura Healing Meditations, who has been publishing the free monthly Reality Shifters e-zine since 1999 through realityshifters.com. Living the Quantum Dream with Cynthia Sue Larson is part of Evolutionary Voices for the Quantum Age, heard Monday through Friday at 8 a.m. and 8 p.m. Eastern on the Dream Vision 7 Radio Network.
Hello, I'm Cynthia Sue Larson, and our guest today is Peter Canova. Peter Canova is an international businessman who, after a series of life-changing spiritual experiences, began writing about spirituality and consciousness. He is the author of the 25-time award-winning First Souls trilogy, and he has contributed to the popular Chicken Soup for the Soul series. Peter hosts the Quantum Spirituality podcast on Dream Vision 7 Radio Network and is author of the book, Quantum Spirituality. Peter lives in Florida, and his website is www.petercanova.com. Welcome, Peter.
Hi, Cynthia. Glad to be in the show.
Oh, so happy to be talking with you. And before we get started talking about your work, I'd love to know what makes you smile when you get up in the morning? On a good
day.
There's
a lot of, there's a lot of things to smile about. I think it's discovery. Every day I'm kind of like eager to discover new things. I do a lot of, research for my books and everything, and I'm always finding out something and, learning something. And also, besides book learning, things come to me, new things come to me, new thoughts, new insights and everything every day. I really try hard to balance that out with going out and getting some physical exercise. I like to ride my bike at least, 5 or 10 miles, try to do it at least 3 times a week and, just kind of get that balance in there, because I don't think it's too good to be too, too cerebral. It's not too good to be too physical. It's all a question of balance. So those kind of things, make me happy.
Love it. Well, you sound like you're just very similar to me. I love to exercise. I love research. Love learning. Your new book is Quantum Spirituality. I just had the joy of reading through that yesterday. The subtitle, mm-hmm. Science, Gnostic Mysticism, and Connecting with Source Consciousness. And how, for the listeners, how would you define what quantum spirituality is?
Well, I think quantum spirituality is about how we can raise consciousness. At the end of the day, it's about how we can raise consciousness using science and mysticism as twin yardsticks. It's also about answering the fundamental questions and having experiences of hidden realities. Ultimately, it deals with life's greatest mysteries, saying, how did we get here? What's our purpose? Is there a higher power? Is there life after death? And answering these questions in the book involves really 4 basic elements, which are faith, belief, knowledge, and revelation. And I think it was important for me to have the readers understand how those elements work. And to kind of give you an example, if somebody told you that water burns, and you read that water burns, and you were kind of a novice, let's say, to the world, you could develop a faith and a belief that water actually burns. But when you finally put your hand in the water, you learn that the truth of it, it doesn't burn. So, faith and belief and secondhand knowledge can be misleading. The only real knowledge that we can rely on is knowledge that's gained by direct experience, which reflects the truth of something. So what quantum spirituality really is about, and the reason I wrote it, is it kind of a guide to help the readers get to a point where they actually can have extraordinary experiences with higher consciousness. And that really is the highest form of the four elements I talked about, which is revelation. That knowledge, that direct experiential knowledge, leads to revelations and insights that kind of connect us, you know, with this higher power. And that's what I'm trying to do. I'm really trying to write a book to help people get those or achieve those extraordinary experiences.
Oh, I love the way that you have the central premise in this book about how we relate to and participate in, like, what you're talking about, this direct experience with reality thanks to consciousness. And you've got some amazing key points in the book, which I think are fascinating. Number one, objective reality does not exist except in the mind of master consciousness. Number two, consciousness operates through transmission of light energy, emitting the energy field called the quantum wave potential. Three, consciousness draws upon the energy field to form different interpenetrating realities and dimensions of existence. Four, I love this, like a stack of pancakes, these dimensions support and affect each other. I love that you talk about this. Number five, personal human consciousness feels like we're independent and separated. And six, humans are the bridge between the material world and the higher energetic dimensions. Now, this is fabulous. I can't say enough good things about the way that you've structured this and this premise. How did you bring all of this together? Was there something that helped you to see this so clearly?
Well, we just ran through a lot for listeners to encompass. So let me go back and kind of start from the beginning to answer this question. You know, it all starts with light. And light is what makes reality possible. We only perceive objects in the physical world by the light that they emit. It's the photons of light that bounce off of these things that we see that connect to the rods and cones in our eyes and then form the images, the electrochemical images in our brain. So we never really experience reality directly out there like there's an independent reality. It's always a subjective experience in the back of our heads through these electrochemical interactions. So back at the turn of the 20th century, a brilliant German physicist named Max Planck founded quantum physics. He started studying the properties of light, and he noticed that light is not emitted continuously, but it comes in little packets or separate packets of energy, and he called them quanta. So that's where we got the term for a new science called quantum physics. So light comes into this world kind of like the frames of a film. If you could picture frames running by the light of a projector, that's essentially how light comes into this world. And Max Planck had some very interesting observations. He said that matter exists because of a force that brings particles of an atom into vibration. And this is a direct quote from him. Behind all matter is a conscious, intelligent mind, which is the matrix of all matter. Now, that is the father of quantum physics, basically saying that there is an intelligent source of light that forms everything that we perceive, every form in existence in the physical world. Then we had Albert Einstein come along and kind of prove that out, because his famous formula, E equals mc squared, states that energy and mass are the same thing. Matter derives from light energy, and it resolves back into light energy. That's the basis for nuclear bombs. You're basically decomposing matter back into its constituent force, and it releases that tremendous nuclear force. But, you know, essentially he proves what Max Planck was saying in his statement, which is that everything that we perceive in the world as solid matter comes from unsolid light energy. And in fact, at the very, very fundamental microscopic level, subatomic level, there are no such things as particles, okay? What we think of as solid particles, atoms and molecules that make up our desks, our chairs, our bodies, the universe, they don't exist at the fundamental level. What exists are waves of light energy. And under certain circumstances, these waves of light energy can collapse into particle form. And interestingly enough, and this is a whole another subject we could talk about, but it's actually appears to be human consciousness that plays a role in helping to collapse those waves into particle form. So, you know, it's the world that we experience is very counterintuitive to what fundamental reality tells us. It's not at all like what we perceive. There's a hidden reality there, a hidden state from which we come from, and that's a lot what we explore in the book.
Absolutely. And many of the people that you've cited in your book, I've interviewed on this show, including Don Hoffman. I've got a physics degree from UC Berkeley, and I've co-authored papers on that there is no such thing as objective reality with a physicist. anyway, I don't want to go into all that. But my listeners are quite familiar with some of these topics, thanks to my fascination for these areas. And I agree with you, about the key to recognizing the subjective true nature of reality. And then, of course, I frequently cite the words of beautiful Max Planck talking about, you know, that we can't get behind consciousness, that consciousness is fundamental. And this idea about the quantum wave potential. And in my own books, I've also delved into the dimensions of existence and these levels of reality. But very few people really talk about it. I think Don Hoffman is one of the few. And of course, he's got such a wealth of background in the way that he looks at reality from the viewpoint.
Yeah, Don's concept is great. Don's concept is great. What I love is his analogy about using a computer icon on a desktop on your computer, and how he says that. Listen, he says we see the icon there. He said, but that's just standing for something that lies beneath it. You know, underneath it is all that information, strings of binary strings of electrons that carry information and things like that. But we don't see that. We just sort of see the narrow end product. And probably the reason that Don says is because in this world to survive, we can't get that complex. We just have to see something as it is without having all this mathematical formulas that we have to go through to get to it, you see.
Absolutely. And then we recognize that so many quantum properties and principles are utilized by living species, such as plants when they photosynthesize and starlings when they move like a quantum fluid and so forth. Yes, nature is rich in these examples of quantum properties and phenomena occurring in warm, wet, messy environments.
Fractals and so forth,
Yes, exactly. But I'd like to delve into that stack of pancakes with the dimensions supporting and affecting each other. I find that particularly pivotal because, for one thing, very few people talk about it. You're one of the few besides myself that brings it up within the context of understanding this central premise that's in your book, Quantum Spirituality. So for those who haven't read your book yet, which I highly recommend everyone should read it, again, it's called Quantum Spirituality. Could you just summarize what is involved in these levels of consciousness that you talk about?
Well, yeah, you know, and it's really interesting because everything we're talking about, we've been talking about quantum, you know, theory so far, but almost everything we're talking about was predicted 2,000 years ago by the Gnostics when they talked about parallel dimensions and they talked about levels of existence, and it just fits in so beautifully with, modern day theories of parallel universes, and this is just one of many, many instances. But essentially, the Gnostic vision was that there was a supreme consciousness, there was a master consciousness, you can call it God, you can call it, you know, the supreme force, call it anything you want. The label doesn't matter. It's the force is the same. But there was an intelligent force, and essentially it projected out other points of consciousness for various reasons. In religious terms, you could say, these other points of consciousness, I suppose Christians would describe them as angelic beings, angels or archangels or whatever. The Gnostics call them aeons or eternities, and essentially they were archetypes. They were thoughts of the supreme consciousness, and they were given names like truth and beauty and wisdom. But you can think of them as currents of spiritual energy revolving around the central source, and they formed their own dimensions so that each of these expressions of the one consciousness were in their own dimensions defined by a dimensional vibration. And the way the Gnostics pictured it, they said, well, look, the first generation of these projections were the highest because they had the highest vibration, so they were the most similar to the source. The next generation down would have been vibrating at a slightly lower level, so they, you know, that would have formed their dimension. And it was all this process of limitation, which essentially gets back into what we were talking about with Hoffman, is that we perceive limited forms. And the reason why everything outside of the central source must be limited is because if it wasn't, there would be no differentiation, no individuation from the central source. If we didn't have limited degrees of the source's consciousness, we would be the supreme source itself rather than the parts. So essentially, it projected itself out into all these various dimensions, which were characterized by vibrations of energy. And the example that I gave, the stacking the pancakes. It what it really says is that the dimension that we dwell in or that we perceive is interpenetrated by other dimensions. And I believe that energy from those other dimensions comes into our universe, even though there certainly would be debate amongst physicists. But, physicists don't really know what energy is. They don't know where it comes from. They don't know where it is. All they know is how to manipulate it under certain circumstances. But other than that, they don't really have a very good concept of what energy is and what it comes from. So I do believe that energy enters in from other dimensions and influences our dimension. And so we are essentially, kind of like the images in the film that I talked about, the frames of a film. We're just one frame, but there's other frames that, precede ours. And together, collectively, you string them together and you have sort of a whole. You have a whole matrix, a whole story that comprises the universe.
Yeah, I love that. I love this whole concept, and I tend to agree with you. And I know firsthand physicists don't necessarily know everything about energy. Because some of them are my friends, the physicists who saved, the hippies who saved physics. those are like quite a few of them got involved with the Foundations of Mind conferences that I was helping to organize and wrote papers for that and so forth. But you have go ahead.
I was just going to say then that I even kind of have a question in my mind about gravity, which is the one force that they've never been able to unify with the other three fundamental forces. And, I just even have a question about where gravity comes from. I'm not 100% sure it wholly arises from within this dimension, but that's just one of my little sidebar quirks.
Good question, and it's a big mystery. But I wanted to say that you've got a fascinating story that got you involved in this quest for understanding spirituality. And I'd love it if you could just talk a little bit about your personal story when you responded to a newspaper ad about a course for developing extrasensory perception, ESP.
Yeah. Well, long ago and far away, as they said in Star Trek, Star Wars, when I was in my 20s, I'd always been kind of curious about, curious about the world. And I answered an ad in a newspaper where they had a course where they were teaching people what was called extrasensory, perception back in those days. And I went to that, and within a short time, I discovered that I was a very accurate medical intuitive. I could, just be given the name, age, and address of somebody, and I would be able to, recite a detailed medical history of them. And I then proceeded, that kind of opened up the floodgates in me, and I started experiencing all these other phenomena like remote viewing and telemetry and clairvoyance, clairaudience. I just had some very, very vivid experiences, and I mean, when I got over the initial surprise of this and just accepted it, I just realized that there's a whole other world out there, and it's like it broadcasts like a 24/7 radio station. The question is, you have to attune to the right frequency. So we can go through our lives never attuning to the right frequency. Well, somehow back then I did it, and I started getting all kinds of information coming through, information that saved my life, that saved other lives, and helped me write my books. The first book I wrote, Pope Annalisa, which was very widely critically acclaimed, about an African nun that became the first female pope. It was almost like channeled. Sometimes I look at it and I say, did I really write that? Because so much of the information was channeled, and it was a geopolitical thriller, and so many of the predictions in the book came true, like Iran going nuclear, the Gulf War. It predicted the Gulf War with, you know, Saddam Hussein and his sons, they wrote an article in Om Times magazine about all the predictions of Pope Annalisa that came to pass. Well, this was information, you know, that I had channeled. So, being a Capricorn and not being satisfied just to have it happen, but I needed to understand the nuts and bolts of it, I started doing research, and that's what led me to quantum physics, because I realized that quantum physics, from a scientific standpoint, was the closest thing to explain what I was experiencing and what I had read about Gnosticism. It was just approaching these fundamental questions of existence through a different door, through an objective and scientific door, as opposed through a subjective and intuitive door. So that's how I, you know, got into these twin streams of science and mystical wisdom.
Yeah, I share that with you, and I earn a living partly as a spiritual life coach, so I do a lot of these intuitive readings where I just practice turning off the rational, you know, mind and just going with the intuition, tuning in to the frequencies, mm-hmm. as you say. Beautiful.
Yeah, they're both needed.
Yeah, and I'm a Capricorn too, so fascinating.
That's fun. That's probably more than a coincidence there, I guess.
I think so. I think there's something to it. Now, here I've got a surprise question for you. I hope it is personal of interest to me. You mentioned in your book, and I'm going to quote something here from page 17. You say, like in the movie Field of Dreams, if you build it, a place in your being, they, experience and knowledge, will come. And here's my question. It's not so much about that, which I think is a brilliant idea, but it's about the movie quote itself. If you build it, they will come. And I want to know, are you aware of the Mandela effect phenomenon related to this line of dialogue from that movie?
The Mandela?
I don't know if you've heard of the Mandela effect. Yeah.
You're not talking about the Mandelbrot? Mandelbrot? Or
is something
okay, I'm not,
Mandela?
No, I'm...
Okay. It's
okay. No, I'm not familiar with the Mandela effect per se, but if you explain it to me, I might be able to link it to what I said.
Yes. Well, exactly. The Mandela effect is it picked up its name from someone who popularized the term, and her name is Fiona Broom, but actually Art Bell was the first one to bring up the fact that Nelson Mandela, people remembered that he'd passed away while he was incarcerated on Robben Island in South Africa. But actually, he didn't die in jail. He died many, many years later. He lived to become the president of South Africa, in fact. So that's where the term Mandela effect came from. It's since been popularized to describe what some people, I think, mistakenly call misremembering or collective misremembering. I would say it's more like mismatched memories. So that people, when they think about dialogue from the movie Field of Dreams, I remember, if you build it, they will come. But now the movie's only ever said, if you build it, he will come. And so it's like a small, tiny change in something. But people bring this up when they talk about the simulation theory, about holographic reality, the matrix of reality, and so forth. So it is totally related to consciousness, to spirituality. And I think it's fascinating that you've got reference to, maybe it's unintended, but there's a Mandela effect right there in the book, and I was just wondering if you'd thought about that. I do actually believe that these things have individual specific value and meaning when you look for it, just like a meaningful coincidence can have meaning. So I don't know if
I hadn't thought about it because I wasn't really aware of the Mandela effect, but I think the reason I put it in there is because if you really want to have extraordinary experiences and raise consciousness and contact the source that we're all connected to, that we're all part of, one of the key things is, I think you have to have, there's certain elements you have to play with. Desire, a strong desire is one thing. That's the emotional and subjective end of it. And then you can go out and you can read up on things like science and everything else. That's the objective part. So what I always say is, you know, it's kind of like, analogous to a rocket. The desire that you have to be open to and searching for these things is like the fuel of a rocket that lifts you off the ground. But once you get off there, you need guidance, and that's where studying and meditating or reading on things can help guide you a bit. That's the guidance system. So the two parts to a rocket are the fuel and the guidance system, and they're both necessary, because with one you can't get off the ground, and with the other you can get off the ground, but then you go around in circles. So I was talking about that. I was talking about building that combination of desire, of faith, of searching in your soul, which opens you up to so many possibilities. That's one of the keys that opens you up. You know, if you just open your heart to these things and you believe in the provision that there is something else out there, even if you're only taking on faith originally, you can graduate from faith to knowledge that these things are there, and then from knowledge to revelations.
Love it. That's brilliant. And I like the way that you just you show that faith to belief, faith and belief to knowledge to revelation pathway. And I love bringing those two things together, that guidance system, beautifully put. And you've this book, when you delve into the Gnostics, I love how you describe that, because that's something I didn't know much about, was the whole background with the Gnostics. And you talk about the quantum discoveries and how they relate to the Gnostics. Could you describe for those who aren't familiar, who were the Gnostics or Gnostics, and what were their beliefs?
Back in ancient times, these so-called pagan, which we call pagan religions, which kind of like almost like a pejorative term now, were more advanced than we were in terms of spiritual knowledge. There was a universal spiritual tradition, which you can detect in all the major religions of the world, even today. So at one time, Hinduism, Buddhism, Zoroastrianism, the three Abrahamic religions, Hellenistic philosophy, the Jewish Kabbalah, all these various either religious or spiritual expressions had some common elements and a common source to them. Now, the interesting thing about the Gnostics is the Gnostics were centered in Alexandria, Egypt, which at the time was the melting pot of the world. You had all the influences coming from the Eastern traditions, as well as the Egyptian Hermetic tradition, the Jewish Kabbalah, and the Greek Hellenistic philosophy. They all kind of converge, and the Gnostics had all of these traditions available to them. And the reason why I centered on the Gnostics as opposed to any other tradition is because more than all the other mystical wisdom texts that I read, the Gnostics were kind of the most scientific, and they most embodied issues and the mythologies that point to what modern science is saying today, modern quantum physics is saying today. And it really gets quite startling. So I can give you some what I call superficial similarities, and then I can go into a deeper dive where I can talk about just how pointedly graphic that they were in terms of predicting quantum physics 2,000 years ago. But, science says that light is the means by which we perceive phenomenal reality, and light energy contains information that forms all reality. And the Gnostics said God is light. The light energy of the supreme consciousness is present by degrees and forms in everything that exists. And in science, we have quantum reality. They say quantum reality is infinite and unchanging. Our world is dynamic forms in a kind of electromagnetic light energy show, which produce the images that we take as reality, which gets into the sort of holographic or simulated world you spoke of. Well, the Gnostics said that supreme consciousness is also infinite and unchanging, but it projects the appearances of dynamic forms in a kind of illusory manner that forms the universe and creation. Quantum physics would say that matter comes from energy. The Gnostic agreed. The Gnostic said that all matter comes from spiritual or light energy. Quantum physics says the world appears to be, indicates that the world appears to be a holographic illusion. And the Gnostics are very explicit in saying the world is an illusion of images perceived by our limited consciousness. So, those are the superficial things, but get at a deeper level. The Gnostics had an amazing creation story. And that creation story is where we directly see them predicting modern quantum theory of phenomena, such as the parallel universes, the Big Bang, and the God particle. And I mean, I can, if you want, I can take some time to explain that. But depending on how much time we have,
minutes. Yeah, let's take a few minutes on that. Because your book really does dive into that, and I think that creation story that you mentioned, to me, when I was reading that, it seemed so pertinent for these amazing times, these last few years.
Yeah.
So it seems relevant.
Well, the Gnostic creation story was fascinating on so many levels because it just touches on just about everything to do with creation and what we experience. But essentially, the Gnostic creation story was that there was the supreme consciousness, or the master consciousness, which was the source of all things, the source of all energy, the source of all what we perceive as matter. And as we said earlier, it projected its consciousness out into different points of consciousness or dimensional points of consciousness that were characterized by archetypal entities. Again, they could be called truth, love, justice, wisdom, and so forth. Very similar to the Platonic archetypes or the archetypes that Carl Jung spoke about, the exact same things. Well, the youngest of these, you could call them mind sons or mind daughters of God, as the Hindus called them, the youngest of these projections of the supreme consciousness was called Sophia. And Sophia is actually a major player in the Bible. The only reason we don't recognize that as such is that we get the English translations of the Bible, which was originally written in Greek. And Sophia in Greek means wisdom. So we see the name wisdom, particularly in the Old Testament, as being described as, I was there from the beginning. I was coterminous with the Lord, with God. In other words, a very high spiritual being that was there at the inception of everything. And she was the youngest of all of these points of consciousness that were orbiting around the source, let's say. And wisdom is kind of strange because what's the nature of wisdom? I mean, how do you grow in wisdom? Well, you grow through experience, right? I mean, you know, that's how wisdom is really accumulated. It's really through experience. So Sophia was the one point of consciousness that desired to have its own individual experience. It wanted to create as the source created. In other words, it wanted to have the same, it wanted to have its own individuality. And so she, and I'm going to use the pronoun she. It's not a person. It's not this giant female form floating in the sky. This is an intelligent energy source, let's say. But I'll, you know, to make it more personal, I'll use these pronouns. So Sophia, she looks outside of this whole orbit of the divine consciousness, and she sees chaos, what modern quantum theory would call the quantum potential. And she starts probing outside into chaos with her mind, thinking that, well, maybe that's the place that I can do something. So eventually she plunges her entire energy into chaos. She makes a break with heaven, in effect. This is the first fall that was described in the biblical terms. It's echoes of this in the Gnostic story. The first fall of consciousness was Sophia, or wisdom, falling into chaos, projecting into chaos. So chaos is essentially not a vacuum. It's not a void space, because you know that science has found there's no such thing as a void. The voids are actually seething with virtual particles, particles that can pop in and out of existence. Now, very interestingly, the Gnostics describe the place, the chaos that Sophia went into, this place of quantum potential. They describe it as full of proto-matter. Proto-matter meaning that which precedes matter, seeds of matter which weren't yet quite matter, right? So wow. Sophia, she plunges into chaos, and the proto-matter swarms around her like iron filings would swarm to a magnet, and they engulf her, and they both start changing. The proto-matter starts to become activated and changing its state. In the meantime, Sophia's high energy is now draining and becoming more dense. And she cries out to heaven, I am becoming as lead. I am becoming as matter. Save me from this matter that engulfs me. Literal words, okay? What is phenomenal about this is that if you know what the God particle is about, the God particle, which was really proven in 2012. It was about a 50-year-old theory that was proved in 2012, which is that our entire universe is surrounded by an energy field they call the Higgs field. And within the Higgs field, you have Higgs bosons, which you can think of them as particles. And when energy enters into our universe from God knows where, these Higgs bosons attach to the energy streams and slow them down to the point where the energy starts to take on the characteristics of mass. So the God particle that you may have heard about in the news, and in, I know it was in some of Dan Brown's books and movies, the God particle is about slowing down the energy and bringing it to the point where it converts into matter. Well, what's this whole story of Sophia about? Sophia is surrounded by proto-matter, which activates and slows her energy down, and she starts to convert into matter. That's the first expression of energy-matter conversion. It's a direct analog, almost, you know, in words that couldn't be closer, except that they didn't have technical terms in that time, okay? So that's the first point. And then we've already discussed the Gnostic story about the parallel universes and the different points of consciousness and how those were parallel universes. The one last thing I'll mention is the Big Bang. So in the Gnostic texts, when Sophia starts to convert into matter and forms this new state of existence, because prior to this, it was all energy waves, right? Now, right. All of a sudden, you have matter plus energy. But the matter and the energy could not coexist on the same plane. So the texts say that this whole dimension of matter that had been formed by Sophia's contact with the proto-matter was expelled in a violent upheaval and projected apart. Well, what is that but the Big Bang? You know, the Big Bang was the appearance of matter out of nothing, out of we don't know what, something on the other side. We don't know what that was on the other side. It certainly most likely wasn't material, but from some immaterial source, something projected apart in a great upheaval and essentially exploded into the world of matter. An exact description in the Gnostic text of how Sophia's new dimension was expelled.
I really love how relatable this story is, the way you describe it. You bring it to life. So I highly recommend people read the book and go through all the details. But this is beautiful. Thank you so much for providing such an eloquent description and summary of that story. And I've got a question for you, which kind of relates to that. Because in your book, you also describe there's a difference between creation and emanation. And I know they mm-hmm. may sound similar to people, but there's a difference, and I'd love you to talk about what it is and why it matters.
Yeah. Well, you know, if most of us in this country were probably raised in, you know, Judeo-Christian tradition, and that tradition essentially said that, you know, God created humanity out of the dust of the earth, and, you know, we were like these separate things. We were like a separate piece of art. Think of Geppetto, the toy maker, okay? Geppetto created Pinocchio, and Pinocchio was a separate creation that was like given life, but he wasn't the same as Geppetto. He was something separate from Geppetto. Well, we were always led to believe that essentially we were something separate from God or the force that created us. But the Gnostics said, it wasn't that way. The Gnostics said that human beings and the human soul was not a separate creation, but was a projection or a flowing out of the essence of the source itself, so that there was no separation between the source and its emanations. The only thing that made a difference was the degree of vibration or the degree of consciousness, so that the emanations were operating more in limited consciousness rather than a supreme consciousness, and the reason for that being, of course, so they could be distinct as individuals, because if, like we said before, if they were the same vibrationary level as the source consciousness, there wouldn't be any individual consciousness. There wouldn't be any individual, beings or the appearance of individual beings. So you need that limitation of consciousness in order to have the whole idea of individuality. But the key thing here, and the key message for everybody from the Gnostics and from everything that I'm starting to add up in quantum physics, is that we are all part of this creative force. We're not separate from it. The only difference is the degree of power and consciousness that we exert, which incidentally can grow over time. We can assume more consciousness, which gives us more creative power over our world and environment. But we are an intrinsic part of that consciousness. We're not these little separate wind-up dolls that were thrown down into this lunatic asylum to bounce off walls with no purpose. There's a purpose for us being here, and the purpose is that we are the bridge between energy and matter. We are the bridge between spirit and matter. And our purpose on this earth is to spiritualize the material and bring the experience of the material back to spirit, so that at one time, I really believe what the kingdom of heaven means is the kingdom of heaven that Jesus spoke about is that time when spirit and matter merged to such an extent that we were like what we were when perhaps we first entered materiality. I believe that when spirits or souls first came here, they were able to project in and out of physical forms, but eventually they got lost and they started to identify the boundaries of their skin as their reality and became essentially trapped by their own thought in the idea or the experience of materiality. And we're sort of trying to work our way out of that thought and understand that we are more universal beings than just what's inside this skin.
I love that quote, that when you say our purpose as humans is to spiritualize the material, that's brilliant. And I love what you're saying about this whole topic. That's my what I want to be when I grow up is like an archangel. So, and it seems at times that I can access higher dimensional levels of conscious agency, and it's so miraculous. So I can just validate what you're saying and really recommend that people take that to heart. We can do it. We can bring light, love, all these high-level concepts in. We can choose to bring it into this what yeah. seems like a heavy existence.
Because this concept of original sin that we have in Christianity is very destructive. It does nothing but separate us from the source. And, you know, it's like where this, these little sinners that that have to, forever atone, for something that we didn't have a whole lot to do about. And, everything is already forgiven because we're part of the source that created us. The only thing that we have to remember is that, we are part of that source. And so when we remember that and we start to reduce the separation between ourselves and the world around us and between ourselves and others, we start to realize that, it doesn't pay to harm others, because in harming others, we ultimately harm ourselves. And what we call evil is simply the extreme ignorance and feeling of separation that allows us to do destructive things to the world and to people because we think we're not part of them. We think we're separate from them. So it has a transformative effect once you really get to this realization. And I don't mean the intellectual realization. I mean, once you have the experience, it's like the first time I had it, it was only, I can only describe it. It was a light. It was a bright light. And I had the feeling in my gut that, wow, everything is connected. We're all part of this world. Otherwise, how did I know all these things about what was going on in somebody else's body? How could I get that information when somebody just gives me a name, an age, and address of a person? We have to be connected in order for me to do that. We have to be connected the way particles, they've proven, are connected in quantum entanglement, so that one particle can instantly react at the speed of light to what's happening to another particle, infinite distances away. It's like if I'm here and I'm on Mars and somebody pinches me here on Earth, I would be saying, ouch, on Mars at the exact same time. That's what quantum entanglement is about, but that's also the same principle of us feeling connected to everything.
Love it. I totally couldn't agree more. And I'd love you if you could share some ideas for something that you describe in your book as the third way. This is a path between these extremes of traditional religion, and then on the other hand, we haven't gotten into it too much, but scientific materialism. What is the third way? How can people find this, and what's the advantage of taking it?
Well, I think what the third way is a recognition that, you have traditional religion, you have traditional science, and they're both on kind of opposite ends of the spectrum, but the weird thing is that they kind of get so extreme, they merge into one another in terms of their methodology. So in traditional religion, we had all these dogmas and things that led to the excesses of the church, particularly in earlier times. But I mean, even to some extent today, churches influence people in ways that aren't always necessarily the most beneficial. Well, then you had a scientific revolution that came along, and it pretty much undercut the pinnings of the underpinnings of religion. I mean, it really started to question the whole foundation of religious belief and everything. But traditional science has its own orthodoxy. And, when you try to discuss ideas like we're talking about here in mainstream academia, you can really be ostracized. You can really, pay a penalty for it, because orthodox religion does not want to deal with anything that can't be tested and observed in a laboratory. They won't recognize anything that can't be tested and observed in a laboratory. And that's incredibly limiting because, it's sort of like, well, we know that quantum science is telling us that what we came from is something way down at a deeper level, and yet these things at the deeper level can't always be tested by our machines and our equipment, so they go unrecognized, and they say, well, that really can't be, and we really shouldn't be asking those questions or exploring those questions. So you have these two types of orthodoxy on the religious side and on the scientific side. But the third way is really a merger between the two, because what's happening is that religion is transcending into spirituality, and science is transcending into quantum understanding, so that these two new frontiers of these sort of orthodox orientations are now merging. And the result is what people like I'm talking about, what people like you're talking about, what people like Hoffman are talking about, the growing belief in science and panpsychism, which means that everything in the universe is a product of consciousness. I mean, that's an actual growing belief in the scientific community today. So, you have traditional religion, but then you have spirituality. You have traditional science, but then you also have quantum science. So these are two evolutionary trends that are transcending their old forms and going into areas and answering questions that neither of them could answer before. And that's what this third way is about.
Excellent. And I disagree with you on so many points here, but it's fun to interview you. I do have one last question before closing out. And what do you most wish people would know and understand? Just about everything we've talked about so far. Just one thing. If you could pick one thing.
Oh, wow. That's a tough one. What I really would like them to know and understand, but of course there's a number of steps before you have to get there, is, on one hand, it's funny. When I get up and I speak in front of an audience, sometimes the first thing I say is, don't believe a damn thing I'm going to tell you. And that's not because I don't want them to listen to what I have to say and consider what I have to say, but I don't want them to take everything on faith of my word. So what I would really like is to see people become their own prophets. I would like to see people get to the point where they can respect and listen to other opinions, but they put in the work to test things out in their own experience, in their own practice, whether that's meditation or whatever other practice they use. Take the information that people like you, like me, like Hoffman, like other people who are along this third path that I spoke about provide, and listen to it. But you don't have to believe everything that we say. Take it provisionally, but put the time and put the practice in to test these ideas out in your own spiritual practice. Because what these things are doing is, nobody can turn the light bulb on for you and give you a revelatory experience. You have to have that yourself. But what people like us can do is create signposts to help guide you on your journey along the way, signposts of knowledge and information that you can absorb and take in and then test out. So I guess if you want me to sum it up, I'd like everybody to become their own prophet.
Thank you. Couldn't say it any better than that myself. And how can people find out more about your work and stay in touch with you? You have a website.
Yeah, I have a website, petercanova.com. That's PETERCANOVA.com. You can read about my works there, and that's where the book is also available. Shortly, I hope to have a video trailer up about the book, which I think will be nice. And then I also have a second website, popeannalisa.com. That's PopeAnnalisa.com. And that's where my fictional works are talked about. I had three books called the First Souls Trilogy, which are about the first souls to incarnate in material experience. And they appear at different junctures of history when there's humanity is either going to, you know, destroy itself or move forward. And they play seminal roles in raising consciousness. And they won 25 awards, the trilogy did, including Best Book Series. And so it's a very exciting read. It's not just dry, you know, platitudes and, spiritual soapboxing. They are really geopolitical thrillers, and a lot of people really love them. So that's another website they can go to.
Well, thank you so much for your time today, Peter, and I do hope to stay in touch with you personally, and I hope everyone else does too, because you're just such a bright light in the world. So till next time.
Well, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Everyone, I hope you keep asking my favorite question, and the cosmos, the universe will answer. How good can it get? Thanks so much. Love you, and take care.
Thank you for listening to this edition of Living the Quantum Dream with your host, Cynthia Sue Larson of RealityShifters.com. Join Cynthia next time in visualizing and accessing whole new worlds of possibility on Evolutionary Voices for the Quantum Age. Heard Monday through Friday at 8 a.m. and 8 p.m. Eastern on the Dream Vision 7 Radio Network.
Calling all authors. Have you been considering an audiobook? Well, look no further. Come take advantage of Dream Vision 7 Radio Network's unique in-house audiobook production, which includes benefits and bonuses from our radio station. Let our knowledgeable staff guide you to create the audiobook you've always dreamed of without breaking the bank. Check out our full one-stop service from A to Z, including the ACX process. Schedule a free consultation by calling 508-226-1723. That's 508-226-1723. Or go to DreamVision7Radio.com.